sir. That's right. It is the Saturday Night Movie Reviews. We'll do it every Saturday at 10:30 right here on WGN. Colin and Eric will be joining me. And here is Colin. Hi, Colin.
Hello.
And
hello there.
Eric. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
All right, guys. We should probably get to it. Now, what did we because we were off last week. So what were the ones, really quickly, just a couple of the major ones that came out last week that you guys want to touch on?
There was The Family.
That's right.
And what did you like the Son movie?
What did you think of The Family, Colin?
This is one of the worst films of the year. It's the one with Robert De Niro and Michelle Pfeiffer as a married couple who are in witness protection after pointing the finger to their mob boss, and they're stuck in France, them and their kids, and of course, you know, the mob boss has henchmen looking for them, and it is really one of the laziest films of the year. I know, you know, Luc Besson, he's a French director, makes a lot of, you know, action films here in America, and I think the movie tries to comment a little bit on French and American relationships. But he does so in such a cliched manner. The jokes, just all of them fall flat, and it even gets even weirder towards the end when the movie Goodfellas figures into the plot. It's just pretty much a train wreck throughout the whole thing.
Eric, what do you think?
Yeah, it's awful. I mean, if there's one thing Luc Besson proved a long time ago with The Fifth Element, is that mixing comedy with his brand of genre filmmaking is not his strong suit. In fact, I don't think he really has a strong suit.
Yeah. I think he's one of the worst filmmakers on the planet, quite frankly. I hate his movies. All right, what was the other one then? Wasn't there another one?
Insidious Chapter 2.
Oh, yes, Insidious Chapter 2. Eric, why don't you tell us what you thought of that?
Yeah, I actually kind of liked it. Where the first film, I thought, had a really strong sort of first two acts and the kind of a lesser climax. I thought this one kind of started off kind of rote, kind of very familiar, kind of the haunted house stuff we've seen James Wan do before. And then it sort of picks up in the second and third act. And really, you know, the first one was sort of, you know, their sort of homage to Poltergeist. This one owes a bit more to The Shining. And then, strangely enough, even Back to the Future Part 2, as they actually kind of go back into the first movie and sort of, you know, replay with events and things like that. And I thought they did some really clever stuff while delivering some pretty decent scares along the way.
Okay.
It's not a great movie, but I had fun with it.
Colin, what about you?
Yeah, I thought it was okay. I'm sort of giving the movie the benefit of the doubt because, I mean, I was a fan of the first one, and, of course, I'm a big fan of The Conjuring. But it almost feels a little too soon after The Conjuring to have another Haunted House movie, especially, you know, one from James Wan. Not a bad thing. I love Haunted House movies. I love what he's done with that genre so far. But, you know, the scares weren't, you know, the scares and the chills weren't quite there because, not as much in a way, just because we just saw The Conjuring. Like, we just saw all these tricks a couple months ago. They're still a little too fresh. But I think I like the movie. You know, I probably will like it more, you know, years down the road when I get some, you know, distance from, you know, the deluge of haunted house movies we've been having lately.
Right. Yeah, I thought it was okay. I didn't like the first one very much, and I felt kind of the same about this one. I think it's a step down from The Conjuring. I think The Conjuring is a much better film. It didn't really do much for me. I was indifferent about both Insidiouses. So there you go. All right, well, let's move on. We're going to cover On Demand first. Eric, tell me about Plus One.
Plus One is a film that premiered in the midnight section of South by Southwest earlier this year, which is where I saw it. It was directed by Dennis Elaidis, who gave us the Last House on the Left remake, the one that we liked.
Yeah.
And this one involves a bunch of college friends who go to a big party, and some kind of weird phenomenon begins taking place that gives the title some literal meaning, where all of a sudden doppelgangers of themselves seem to be appearing all over the party and all over the area. It sounds like an intriguing premise. It sounds like something that could, you know, spin off into either something fun or horrific or any number of possibilities with this thing. And it just kind of lays flat. And it never really develops into some sort of cohesive, you know, reasoning why this is going on or what all the characters, how they're going to react to this kind of stuff. It's a lot of you know, setup and a whole lot of, and a payoff is just nothing. There's just nothing there. It was a pretty horrendous experience, actually.
Okay. All right. So that's Plus One, which is available on demand right now. And all right, what about this one? I'm so excited to see this one. I didn't know it was going to be on demand this week.
Yeah.
But this is a new film called All Is Bright with two of my favorite Pauls, and directed finally a follow up to Junebug.
Yeah.
From this director. When was Junebug? That was like 2005 or something, right?
2005.
Man, oh man.
Last movie.
What are you, Kubrick? What?
Yeah, so this, yeah, I mean, I know Colin's a big fan of Junebug.
So am I.
Yeah, we all are. And All Is Bright. I mean, you look at the poster for the thing, and it looks like it almost looks like it's like Deck the Halls or something. It's you know, it's the two Paul Giamatti and Paul Rudd in front of Christmas trees, and they all look kind of beat up.
Yeah.
Paul Giamatti plays a guy who has just been released from prison, 4-year stint, and his wife has left him, told their daughter that he has actually died. He's pretty much got nowhere to go.
You know, by the way, that sounds like a role written for Paul Giamatti.
The movie is completely written for Paul Giamatti. I mean, seriously, you're watching the movie, like, there's no other person who could play this role but Paul Giamatti. Okay? And it gets worse for the guy. His good friend's played by Paul Rudd, and he finds out that Paul Rudd has actually been sleeping with his ex-wife while he's been in prison. He does not in a nefarious kind of way. He's, you know, just kind of moved in.
Yeah.
But Paul Giamatti wants to go straight, and he wants, you know, to, you know, possibly maybe reconnect with his family at some point. So he and teams up with Paul Rudd to sell Christmas trees. The movie's set in Canada, and they go across the border to Brooklyn to sell these Christmas trees. And it's basically they're sort of their time together in basically this vacant lot trying to sell Christmas trees. Sally Hawkins plays a Russian maid who befriends Giamatti. She's looking after a house up the street. Amy Landecker plays Giamatti's ex-wife. And the movie actually, it sort of plays a sort of an interesting companion piece to Prince Avalanche in a way. And Paul Rudd doing a French-Canadian accent, that's funny right there.
Right.
Giamatti is really good in the movie, as you might expect, taking on this kind of role.
Right.
The movie, it's like 107 minutes, and yet it feels longer. It really sort of takes its time in between its big moments and scenes even. But there really is good stuff throughout this movie. Certainly more than enough to recommend.
Oh, good.
So I'm definitely recommending people check it out. It's called All Is Bright.
All Is Bright. Paul Giamatti, Paul Rudd. I saw the trailer for this thing, and I was like, okay, I'm in.
Yeah,
I'm so in.
You'll definitely enjoy it. Yeah. It's not Junebug, but you know, it's a movie that probably deserves a better fate. It probably has right now.
How's Sally Hawkins in it? Is she good?
Oh well, she's got the accent down.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because it could be a good year for her, you know.
Yeah, I think her role is a little bit superfluous.
Yeah.
The things that are going on in the movie, I'd rather they stay a little bit more between the Pauls.
Yeah,
but no, she's always kind of welcome.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think she's determined. I think she's absolutely on her way to get a supporting actress nomination for Blue Jasmine. I keep telling you guys every week that movie, I like it more.
Yeah.
Blue Jasmine. It's like, when I first saw it, I thought, oh, it was good. Nice performances. And now I keep thinking about it. I'm like, you know what? That movie was good.
It'll be in your film club by next year.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right. And the other one that I wanted to mention before we take a quick break here is called COG. And I am a huge David Sedaris fan.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I saw the trailer for this thing, and I'm really curious about it. It's on demand. It's autobiographical. It's about David Sedaris.
Yeah, and it premiered at Sundance this year. I didn't get to see it there, but I know some people who did and who liked it. Didn't love it. It was directed by a guy named Kyle Patrick Alvarez, who did a film some years ago that was at Cinevegas. That I'm drawing a blank on the. Oh, Easier than Practice. It was the name of the film that was actually really terrific. There's Jonathan Groff and Dennis O'Hare and Corey Stoll from Midnight in Paris and The House of Cards. If you're a fan of David Sedaris, this, from what I hear, is worth checking out.
I'm just interested to see who plays his crazy-ass sister, Amy, that I'm just curious about that. Now, you know, I'm a big Sidaris fan, so I'm going to look. I'm familiar. It's at the Gene Siskel Center, by the way. Mm-hmm. It's at the Film Center right now, and the showtimes are 8 o'clock, I think, during the week. But it's also available on demand. So if you're a David Sidaris fan, you might want to check that out. All right, Eric, Colin, hang on, guys.
Okay.
All right. Eric and Colin are with me, as they are every week, for the Saturday Night Movie Reviews. If you have a question or a comment and you want to review something yourself, 312-981-7200. A couple of more straight to on-demand movies we're going to talk about, and then we'll get to the big theatrical stuff. And Eric is going to give us a big summation of the Toronto International Film Festival. All that and more right here on WGN. Yes, sir. Saturday Night Movie Reviews in full swing. 312-981-7200. It's Nick DiGilio here on WGN. And Colin and Eric are here, and we're reviewing some on-demand features. Then we'll get to the stuff that's in theaters as well. So, Colin, I understand that you saw one of these on-demand movies as well as Eric. Colin, why don't you tell us about Blue Caprice?
All right. Well, this is based on the story of the DC Snipers, that father and son team of snipers who are randomly gunning down civilians in Washington, D.C. with, you know, no apparent motive or agenda. And, of course, they weren't really father and son, but they definitely had that type of relationship. And this film explores the nature of that relationship and how these two met each other and how they needed each other. Isaiah Washington plays the elder, the guy who is he's forbidden from seeing his wife and kids ever again, and he's now slumming in the Caribbean, where he meets a boy named Lee, played by Takan Richmond. Lee seems to just live for nothing. He has no guidance, he has no parental figures around, no interest in anything around him. He's a guy in need of a leader, and Isaiah Washington needs a follower, or a son to fill the hole in his life. So they move to America, and they move from house to house, eventually taking up residence with an old friend of his, played by Tim Blake Nelson, and his wife, played by Joy Lauren Adams. And Nelson is big into guns, and he takes Lee out target shooting, and finally Lee has something he's good at. And Isaiah Washington, meanwhile, is rambling on more and more about how the world needs a wake-up call and how random violence is the only answer. And he seems to be randomly creating this nihilistic manifesto. Lee is listening and absorbing every word of it. So this is not an exploitative take on these horrific killings. This is really an exploration of two severely damaged minds and how they feed off each other. How can anyone, bring themselves to commit such evil acts is a question we've all asked ourselves at one time or another. When this story unfolded, when the Colorado shootings, when the Newtown shootings unfolded, that's the question we all ask ourselves. And that's the question the movie attempts to answer as best it can, even if there are no easy, answers. But this movie does a great job of deconstructing the minds of two guys who could bring themselves to commit these acts. The moment they start their shooting, that comes late in the film. So the director, Alexander Moores, is a first-timer, and writer R.F.I. Porto, they're in no hurry to get to the murders. They're more interested in the psychology at play here. So, and this movie's not out to make these guys look sympathetic at all. The performances are all fantastic. The director, Alexander Moores, I think he shows great promise here. He knows how to draw a viewer in with it's very deliberately paced. And even though you know what's coming, it's still shocking. So I think this is a really terrific film, highly recommended.
Wow.
It's dark. There's no light at the end of this tunnel, but I definitely recommend it.
Cool. Okay. Eric?
This film did not work for me at all. Like Colin said, it's not a film that is interested in sensationalizing. It's not a movie, to really sort of strike up, you know, sort of a point of view necessarily for or against these people, but at the same time, we're struck with the only point of view we have, which is, you know, inside, you know, these two people's, you know, their time together. And the movie, I think, more closely makes a case to put us in the sense of trying to understand how two people can, you know, commit these murders, and almost siding with them a little bit, in that these are the people who were cast aside through, you know, the worst, you know, as you know, just bad circumstances, and how, you know, maybe this could happen to any one of us. I don't think it necessarily explores the psychology as well as Colin did. The film just doesn't feel that, like, there's a real urgency in exploring anything to me. It just felt like, here's, you know, the way that the movie is presented, and the languid pace of the film, because it doesn't really sort of take a side. It actually felt more like I was watching a television movie, which would sort of put it in the sort of the sensationalized, you know, section that, you know, something you might see on Lifetime or TNT or something like that, ripped from the headlines. Is a film, I don't know, it just did not work for me on any level like that.
Okay. Oh, well, two wildly different responses to Blue Caprice, which is available now on demand. I've always been a fan of Isaiah Washington's. I think he's a terrific actor. And I know that there was all that controversy that he started when he was on Grey's Anatomy and all the homophobic remarks and stuff that he made. But I always was like, oh man, that's too bad, because the guy is a talent. Ever since I saw him in Clockers, I've always thought Isaiah Washington was just the deal. And you know, I don't agree with him, you know, politically or in terms of what his homophobia is. I think he's a terrific actor, and you know, and I always kind of look forward to seeing him. I thought he was never going to work again. So,
right.
Yeah. All right, you guys, hang on. We got the news coming up, and then we'll come back. We've got more movies to review, and Eric is going to give us a summation of the Toronto Film Festival as well. All that coming up right here after the news, which is next. Nick DiGilio here on The Voice of Chicago, 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studios on the 7th floor of Trib Tower. Here till midnight. Dave Plyer comes in after midnight. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. If you want to check us out, you can send text to 24720. You can follow us on Twitter. And you can stay connected with us on Facebook, facebook.com/NickDShow. Like us. We want to hit 9,000 fans when we can. We're getting pretty close. We want to see if we can hit 9,000 fans, which would be awesome. So facebook.com/NickDShow. Colin and Eric are with me. We have moved the Friday night movie reviews to midnight movie reviews to Saturday. So it's the Saturday night reviews. And Colin and Eric, welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
All right, we've been talking about the on-demand things. So, Eric, why don't you tell us about Jewtopia?
Okay. Before I give you this premise, let me state that this is based on the hit stage play. So keep bearing
really?
That in mind.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. So Jewtopia tells the story of a guy played by Ivan Sergei. I was in a wonderful film called The Opposite of Sex many years ago. He plays a guy that in college, sort of the love of his life, dumped him because he wasn't Jewish. So years later down the road, he goes to a Jewish singles night, being a crazy Gentile that he is, just offends pretty much everybody. But on his way out, he meets a woman looks just like Jennifer Love Hewitt. And he immediately pretends that he's Jewish. And to not get his heart broken again, he enlists his longtime Jewish friend from childhood to show him the ways of the Jewish persuasion so he can pass as a Jew and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, so you got stereotypes abound. You have a lot of occasional offensive, you know, slurs coming in there, all in at the expense of a screenplay or a story that's just not as funny, not as edgy as it thinks it is. It kind of goes randomly between his quest, and then it goes back to his Jewish friend, played by Joel David Moore, on his quest to sort of be more Gentile. So you have this sort of this trading places type thing going on at the same time. Very little of it works, if any at all. I think I chuckled two or three times. I don't know how this played on the stage, but it certainly doesn't work as a movie.
Oh, okay. All right. You get to see a lot of Jennifer Love Hewitt or no?
No.
All right. Well, then I don't care.
Right.
All right. All right. Colin, why don't you tell us about Good Old Frida, which I cannot wait to see, actually.
Yeah, this is a documentary. It's playing at the Music Box right now. It's also on demand.
Right.
That's how I saw it. And it's the story of Frida Kelly, who was the Beatles' secretary for 10 years, their whole 10-year time together.
Yeah.
She's a shy teenager living in Liverpool, and she went and saw these guys at the Cavern and just sort of became a fan early on. And they asked her to be their secretary before they were even close to being famous yet. And she said, yeah, sure, why not? You know, she basically stayed loyal to them, you know, from the time before they were famous to the time after they broke up. So she was there. She was the fly on the wall a lot. And she has basically sort of withdrawn from that sort of celebrity status. She's never cashed in on it. She's never exploited it. So this is her now finally telling, you know, her stories for the first time in, you know, 50 years. You know, she has like three or four boxes full of stuff in her attic. You'd think she'd have more, but she gave a lot of it away back in the 70s. So she's, you know, opening up these boxes for the first time in like, you know, 30 or 40 years. And, you know, she's got some great stories to tell, a lot of fun. And you know, she really hasn't changed that much. She's a very, you know, vivacious and very nice individual. And, you know, the director of this movie, Ryan White, does a really good job of just letting her tell the stories. I mean, the other people come into play too. There's a lot of other, you know, people who are you know, talking about Frida and you know, her impact on the Beatles' lives and everything. So, you know, this is pretty much a must-see for any Beatle fan out there. You know, she's telling stories that we haven't heard yet. You know, we think we've heard it all with the Beatles, you know, after countless documentaries and the anthology and all that. And now finally here's somebody who was there, you know, knew them personally, knew their parents personally. And this is just a real treat for any Beatle or any music fan in general about what it's like to, you know, be behind the scenes of a big rock band and you're handling the fan base, you know, on a daily basis and answering hundreds of letters from around the world on a daily basis. So this is great stuff.
I can't wait. I seriously can't wait. I cannot wait to see this thing. I think I know what I'm going to be watching later on when I get home. So good old Frida. It's such a, and I, you know, I didn't even know that this was a movie. I didn't even know that they were making a movie out of this.
No, I didn't either. Yeah. I'd heard about it. Somebody telling me about it a few months ago, and it just, I couldn't wait to see it. It's a treat.
Awesome. Can't wait to see it. That's Good Old Frida. It's at the Music Box, and it's also available on demand. All right, one more on-demand movie before we break and go on to the regular theatrical films. Eric, tell us about Paradise.
Okay. Well, this is the latest film not only written by, but making her directorial debut, Diablo Cody.
Can I say a hell of a cast?
Yeah, very much. Very much so.
Yeah.
This is the story of a young, very devout Christian woman, very devout Christian community, played by Julianne Hough, who suffered a very, very tragic accident where a large portion of her body was burned. So she's covered in burn marks and scar tissue. And she makes a dramatic announcement to her congregation that she's basically renouncing God and she's going to go off on a little sort of adventure of sin, basically. And where else are you going to go? Well, Las Vegas, of course. So she heads to Las Vegas, basically with sort of a laundry list of all the sins that she wants to commit, including drinking and going to strip clubs and all that kind of good stuff. And she meets in the course of this one evening that she has there a number of other different people. She meets a bartender played by Russell Brand. She meets a lounge, sort of a wannabe lounge singer played by Octavia Spencer. And they sort of become her guide to Las Vegas, is taking her around to complete her tasks and whatnot. And this is a movie that pretty much might just cement the fact that Diablo Cody's words should be handled by nobody but Jason Reitman. For one, you mentioned the cast. This is very much an exercise in miscasting. Right from the very top, Julianne Hough is just really kind of awful here. She does not know the sort of the rhythms of Diablo Cody stuff, so it's a lot of the stuff that registers very false. Russell Brand is just doing Russell Brand and trying to hear Diablo Cody's, quips and things like that through Russell Brand just doing, what he does with his accent doesn't really work. The only one who really kind of seems to get it is Octavia Spencer, who is, again, I think is really pretty good here. The other people in the cast you probably saw, both Holly Hunter and Nick Offerman, play Julianne Hough's parents, who fit into the very beginning of the movie and the very end. Oh. They have probably about 5-6 minutes screen time top. Nick Offerman doesn't even have a line of dialogue until like the last 10 minutes of the movie.
Oh.
Yeah. This is a real disappointment, really from top to bottom. It does have some laughs. It does have some moments, mostly delivered by Octavia Spencer. But this is a film that Diablo Cody doesn't really have quite the grasp of her own rhythms as a director. So this is definitely one to skip.
That's always amazing to me that that great writers or playwrights can screw up their own plays.
Yeah,
like the film version of Oleana is terrible because Mamet screwed it up. I mean, and I've seen several productions of Oleana, and I actually think Oleana is a pretty remarkable play.
Which I've never seen the play, so I only have the movie, though.
Well, and David Mamet clearly takes the man's side in the movie, and he wrote a play that was ambiguous. I've read it, I've seen productions of it, and then I'm watching it, and I'm like, somebody else should have directed this.
Well, I think it's pretty ambiguous at the end.
For me, it's anti woman and pro guy, that movie. For me the play and the productions that I've seen of it, it's anti PC. It's more about politics than it is about gender.
Okay,
and that's what I always do. By the way, I was looking at Holly Hunter's thing. You know, are you aware, Colin? Are you aware of David Gordon Green's next movie?
No, I have not looked at his IMDb page lately.
There's no plot or anything to it, but he's a co-writer of it. He's directing it, and it's called Manglehorn. Al Pacino, Chris Messina, Holly Hunter, and Harmony Korine.
Wow.
Yeah. Al Pacino and Holly Hunter are going to be in the next David Gordon Green movie. What the hell? That's got to come quicker. That's got to come out tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Wow.
Oh, there you go. There's something to look forward to. All right, guys, we're going to hang on a second, and we're going to talk about some of the theatrical films. I can't believe you guys didn't go together to see Battle of the Year.
Too many dudes.
That seems like one of our outings.
I swear to God, I thought I was going to hear you two guys, because I didn't see it. And I thought I was going to. All right, but Colin, you did see it. Of course you did.
I saw it.
Yeah, those are your favorite movies of all time, those kind of things. All right, everybody hang on.
We got
Eric and Colin to talk about all the new movies, and we'll talk about some of the theatrical stuff as well. And Eric's going to give us a quick summation of the Toronto Film Festival, which ended just this past week. Nick DiGilio here on The Voice of Chicago 720 WGN. We're here till midnight tonight. Every Saturday night, 8 to midnight. Sometimes we'll be preempted by Hawks games and things like that, so we'll be on a little bit later. But every Saturday night, we do the new movie reviews, and Colin and Eric are with me. And Colin and Eric, welcome back, guys.
Hello.
All right. Colin, man.
You.
Battle of the Year, buddy. Let's hear about Battle of the Year. Now, this is the guy who you've seen all the Step Up to the Streets movies or whatever the hell they're called.
Right. Sure, we all have.
Yeah, well, you have. And
Eric. Yeah,
yeah, and Eric. I stopped.
Throw him under the bus, too.
I stopped after one. I believe.
Oh.
I know. I'm
That's the wrong place to stop.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, seriously.
All right. I saw honey.
Well, let me ask
I saw honey. Does that count?
Not unless you saw
sure,
honey
I'll
two.
Give you honey.
Okay. I've not seen honey two.
Well, then it doesn't count.
All right, Colin. Battle of the year.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. Do you know what B-boy is? B-boying. You know what that is?
I think I have an idea.
Okay. It is the original term for breakdancing before people used the term breakdancing. Oh. And I did not know this. I mean, this is a fact, but I did not know this until after I saw this movie.
Oh, so you learned something.
Yeah, I did learn something, but the movie doesn't explain that. I found that out on the internet later.
Oh.
I really didn't learn anything from this film. I was a little taken aback when the term got thrown around, you know, during the opening of the film. I was laughing my head off, what the heck is B-boy? And then I realized. Anyway, I will keep calling it breakdancing out of respect for Lucinda Dickey, the star of Breakin', who is a girl breakdancer.
Thank you, Colin.
Yes. So basically, there's a worldwide breakdancing tournament called What Else? Battle of the Year. Germans, Swedes, Japanese, Koreans, Latin Americans, Canadians, U.S., they all compete. But the U.S. hasn't won in decades. And so the man in charge of putting dance crews together hires his old friend, played by Josh Holloway of Lost.
Wait a minute. Sawyer's in this movie?
Sawyer is in this movie. Sawyer is the star of this film.
Oh, okay. Okay, go ahead.
Anyway, he has to coach a new group of the best breakdancers in the nation. Holloway is not a breakdancer in this film, just not to get your hopes
okay,
up.
Okay, all right.
He is a former basketball coach and now an alcoholic since his wife and son were killed in a car crash.
Oh, God, this sounds fantastic. Okay, keep going.
The alcoholism is not a problem, though, because once he takes the job, he gets back to work. He doesn't seem to need to drink anymore. That's usually how it works.
Oh, yeah,
not a problem. So he brings himself up to speed on breakdancing by watching the 2007 documentary Planet B-Boy, which was directed by Benson Lee, who is the director of this film. So there's some meta thing going on here.
Right.
Anyway, Holloway assembles your typical multi-ethnic crew and teaches them how to be a team. Anytime someone uses the word I, everyone has to do 100 push-ups. So anyway, about halfway through, a woman is brought in to teach them actual dance moves, and then they go to the tournament, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. So yes, as you say, I am a fan of the Step Up movies, for three reasons. One, they fit perfectly into the mold of so bad it's good. They're fun on that level. They're fun on the level of pure nostalgia for guys like me who grew up watching ridiculous dance movies like Breakin' 1 and 2 and Beat Street and all that stuff. And it works because I like the Step Up movies because the dance scenes are really good and they're well shot and they're fun to watch and there's a lot of heart in them. But even I can't get behind some of those breakdance movies from the 80s. Well, not some, but like Body Rock is a pretty unwatchable film on every level. And this might be this generation's Body Rock.
Oh, man.
Put that in the ad.
It starts out on that, pretty well on that so bad it's good level while the movie is setting itself up. I mean, I was laughing pretty consistently for the first 15 minutes of this film. But then it just kind of gets a little too boring, and lazy, and not just in terms of the story, which is obviously boring and lazy, but the dance scenes themselves are not exciting or fun to watch at all. And I mean, these are some great dancers in this movie, and the director just can't stop cutting away from them. There's no big dance move that the movie is building up to that these guys need to learn or anything like that. You know, there's no great challenge for them.
Okay, Colin, hold on, because we got to hit the news, but I want you to finish afterwards, okay? Hold on. There's okay. Colin and Eric. Colin is in the middle of reviewing Battle of the Year. We'll get more coming up after the news. Nick DiGilio here on the Voice of Chicago 720 WGN. Saturday night movie reviews continue. We'll also have Eric is going to give us a summation of the Toronto Film Festival. But Colin was in the middle of a very important review for the new dance film Battle of the Year. You can continue now, Colin.
Yeah, so while it is the Battle of the Year, that is important. You know, that is why we must continue
to
discuss it. Anyway, yeah. So the dance scenes are poorly choreographed, or not choreographed, but poorly shot, poorly edited, and there's nothing to like really, you know, to look forward to as far as any big dance move. I mean, really, I mean the main character is a basketball coach. At least throw some basketballs into the dance scenes, and you know, like really spice it up a little bit, do something with it. Anyway, so yeah, no, it's not a good movie in even the so bad it's good sense, except for maybe the first 15 minutes. Like, well, you know, the opening credits are pretty hilarious. You know, when you got an actor in the credits and his name is Flips, that's pretty funny. And by the way, the movie's in 3D, and the 3D is useless. I took the glasses off for about 20 minutes and didn't really notice anything, you know, that I was missing. So, yeah. Can't recommend it really on any conceivable level. So, yeah.
All right. Well, all right. Now let's move on. Eric, why don't you tell us about Thanks for Sharing?
Okay. Thanks for Sharing. New film written and directed by Stuart Bloomberg, who is one half of the writing committee who did The Kids Are All Right. Like that one, this one stars Mark Ruffalo in a story about sex addicts. Mark Ruffalo plays one such addict, and he goes to council meetings for it and is joined by fellow sex addicts, including Tim Robbins and Pink, the singer Pink, and one of my least favorite actors on the planet, Josh Gad. The best thing he ever did was not be in the version of the Book of Mormon that I saw. So this is a story of coming to terms with sex addiction, and Mark Ruffalo's character meets a woman, played by Gwyneth Paltrow. Is it too soon for him to be getting into sort of a stable relationship? That's one of the questions the movie asks. Of course, this is one of those movies where he's not going to reveal what his big secret is until, of course, very late in the film, when all these secrets tend to be revealed in movies like this, and things just don't go right from there. If you're going into this movie expecting shame, you're not really getting that. At the same time, if you're expecting this to be sort of a more of a lighthearted, you know, or almost sort of a goof on what a lot of people, how a lot of people actually view the whole idea of sex addiction, like how could that be a horrible thing? You're not really going to get that either. So you sort of have this in-between thing where it doesn't really take the subject matter completely seriously, but probably takes it too seriously for its own good. You know, the performances are fine. You know, watching these actors do what they do is, you know, not the worst way to spend time. But at the same time, you wish that they had a screenplay that was a little more focused and, you know, either took one of those, you know, those varying approaches to the material. And this one, you know, wants to kind of have it both ways. Sometimes the material is very lighthearted. Sometimes it gets very dark. I didn't learn anything more about sex addiction than I did with shame, frankly. So do not recommend this one.
Yeah, I'm with you on this. My thing about this movie was just how dark it gets.
At that time, yeah.
I mean, I was like, what the heck? What are we doing here? I mean, because it gets really dark. And I was not the biggest fan of The Kids Are All Right, and it, you know, I liked it.
Yeah,
I think more of the performances than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, I guess I just don't like the style of the writing. It, you know, it wants to have its cake and eat it too, as you mentioned.
Yeah, my bigger problem with The Kids Are All Right was the way they sort of treated Mark Ruffalo's character at the end of that movie.
I totally agree with you. But I will say this: I didn't like. I'm not recommending this movie. It's schizophrenic and gets way too dark. But I really like Tim Robbins in it. I thought Tim Robbins was great.
He's good.
I thought he was great. And that the subplot involving, you know, his family doesn't need to be there. That's a real...
No.
At all.
Did you get his son?
But I'm telling you that I thought Tim Robbins was great in it. And it was so if you're a Tim Robbins fan, he's good, I think. But mm-hmm. I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah.
All right, Colin, why don't you tell us about Prisoners?
All right. Well, this... tells the story of two sets of families who are best friends in a suburban neighborhood, Hugh Jackman and Maria Bello. They have two kids, a teenage son and a little girl. And then there's Terrence Howard and Viola Davis, and they have a teenage daughter and a little girl. So they get together on Thanksgiving, and in the middle of the day, the kids decide they want to go out and play. They go for a walk with the older brother, and they come upon an RV parked outside a house on their block, and they play on it a little, and then they keep going. And later that day, the kids go back outside to play, and suddenly they're gone. Nobody knows where they are. They're officially missing, and the only thing that might lead to a clue is the RV, which is also now gone. The detective, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, is brought in to lead the search, and they find the RV in a parking lot and find the driver inside, who happens to be a mentally impaired man with the mind of a 10-year-old, so they say, played by Paul Dano. He lives with his mom, played by Melissa Leo, and Hugh Jackman is convinced that this guy knows where the little girls are and that this whole thing is a fake. And the police don't really have enough evidence to convict him or hold him. So Jackman has to kind of take the law into his own hands and kidnaps Paul Dano in hopes of making him talk. Meanwhile, Jake Gyllenhaal is still following leads and trying to solve the case. This is directed by a guy named Denis Villeneuve, I think.
Yeah,
how you pronounce it.
Something like
Villanueva.
That.
Villanueva?
Villanueva? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Anyway, he directed a great movie a few years ago called Incendies, and he seems to like to direct movies that, you know, slowly reveal their secrets. He likes to explore family lineage and the weird twists and turns they have when you get deeper into them. This isn't nearly as good as that film, but it's his touch that gives this film like a considerable boost, because the script I thought was pretty pedestrian stuff. The big reveal is not that big of a surprise, and the MacGuffins being thrown at the audience are pretty standard, but worse, they're not fully explained. The performances are mostly very good. I think Jackman goes a little overboard at times. But ultimately, this is a movie that benefits greatly by having a strong director at the helm. What I find interesting about this guy is what he chooses not to show. There are many moments that most directors wouldn't dare cut away from because they would generate some really juicy performances or intense action. This guy sometimes likes to cut just as those moments are about to happen, and you know they're about to happen. But he shows you just enough to build suspense, but then gets right to the next bit of business. And even at 2 hours and 20 some minutes, as long as this movie is, that's still some economical storytelling, right up to the final moment, which the final shot, which I thought was pretty brilliant. So I recommend Prisoners more for how it was directed than how it was written.
Okay. Eric, what about you?
Well, this is a movie that I was very much with for a good portion of the film. And the first two-thirds of the film, I think, are pretty riveting. Like a lot of the stuff Colin talks about is about the way it was filmed and shot and edited. I'm very much in agreement with. I actually like.
By the way, I want to mention that Roger Deakins shot this movie.
Oh yes,
and he's a god. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
I like Hugh Jackman a bit more than Colin did. I think that's the kind of over the top that a parent in a situation like that, especially with his sort of background a little bit, might go with. Then the film takes some turns in the final third of the movie, and I think we get to the point where the movie started off in sort of a realm of what TV has seen with both the killing and BBC's Broadchurch, and then it becomes a little more than Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And it was very disappointing to see it take that turn in such very standard, very manipulative ways. And it also started to reveal just how idiotic the cops are in the movie, just how bad the police work is, and so much so that there are clues dropped throughout this movie, very obvious things that the audience will pick up on that, you know, sometimes, you know, all cops are clearly not, maybe not privy to, but they're just, they're so, they make it seem so obvious, especially in the climax, that you just, the whole thing just started to collapse for me like a house of cards. The final, I mean, there's so much information divulged to the audience through newspapers here that the cops don't even seem to read. And the final shot of the movie, the way I was sitting there in the theater where I saw this in Toronto, actually, and I'm sitting there, I'm like, don't fade to black. Don't you dare fade to black right now. And what did it do? Fades to black. And sort of absolves certain characters of their sins without giving any consequences to them. So I wish that I had something more favorable to say, but the final third of this movie killed it for me, and I can't recommend it.
Wow. All right. I loved this movie. I thought it was great, and I was riveted throughout. It's a little long, you know. I mean, it's 2.5 hours, but I guess they could have cut maybe 5-10 minutes out of it and tightened it up a little bit. I think this movie's terrific. I was riveted the whole time. It was like, for me, I was kicked in the gut several times during this movie. And really, it was one of those movies that just left me drained. When it was over, I was just sitting there like, oh my God. So I was blown away by it. I think it might be Jackman's best performance. I really do. Or at least since The Fountain. I think it's like the best work that he's done. I think Gyllenhaal is great. The performances all the way around are terrific in this movie. And it's and you're absolutely right, Colin. This is a beautifully directed movie. And again, we mentioned Roger Deakins. It's gorgeous to look at. This movie had me by the heart and by the stomach for the entire running time of this movie. I was absolutely riveted by it. And I mean, there are a few red herrings that are just red herrings. You know what I mean? And I agree with you, Colin, to a certain extent. I don't think the script is quite as good as the acting and the direction here, but I was, you know, on the simplest of levels, for me, it worked exceedingly well as a thriller. And I was, when it was over, I was drained. And I think it's great. I really did. I thought it was terrific, and I highly, highly recommend it. So we're all over the map on this one.
So, yeah, pretty much. Yeah,
pretty cool. All right. Well, Hey, well, first of all, what do we got next week, Eric?
Well, what we got next week? We got Ron Howard's film Rush comes out next week. I believe Enough Said opens in the Chicagoland area with Julie Louis-Dreyfus, yeah, James Gandolfini. There's a lot of stuff opening next
week.
Okay,
well, we'll cover it. We'll cover it all. We actually get on the air next week at 10 o'clock, so we'll jump right to our regular features and get you guys on right away, okay?
Yeah.
All right, Eric, you hang on.
Mm-hmm.
Eric, you hang on. We're going to talk a little bit about Toronto. Colin, thanks, man. We'll talk to you next week.
Alrighty, bye-bye.
All right, take care. There you go. We'll come back real quick with a summation of the Toronto Film Festival from Eric. All right, Nick DiGilio here on The Voice of Chicago, 720 WGN. We're wrapping up the show with Eric Childress telling us a little bit more about Toronto. And how many movies did you totally see?
While I was in town, I saw 43. New record, my friend.
Oh, my God, you're nuts. All right,
there it is.
We got like 4 minutes here, so just pick a few, and try and get some of the major ones in there that you liked or that you want to warn people about.
Well, I had mentioned Gravity was my favorite of the festival. That was well established. My second favorite film of the festival, probably the second, one of the few films I would say was really great, was Jason Reitman's Labor Day.
Oh, okay.
With Kate Winslet and Josh Brolin, more of a drama than a comedy. Just sort of continues Reitman's streak of sort of these quirky, oddball romances. His sort of version of romances. It's a wonderful, wonderful movie.
Okay, great. Josh Brolin, Kate Winslet, and that's Labor Day, which will be coming out a little bit later on in the year. Okay, next.
Another one picked up by CBS Films is called The F Word. The F, not exactly what it sounds like. It actually stands for friend. And it stars Daniel Radcliffe and Zoe Kazan, and it's directed by Michael Dowds, who directed Goon.
Mm. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
This is another film definitely worth recommending. The sort of the two people in the friend zone. How do they sort of, you know, make that transition. Radcliffe, he's really becoming a favorite actor of mine. Yeah. He's really terrific in this movie. First movie I really like Zoe Kazan, too.
All right. That's cool. And I'm looking forward to that. I'm glad Daniel Radcliffe, you know, because I really like that kid. And mm-hmm. You know, you got to see him in Sparks as well. Or not Sparks.
Yeah.
Horns. Yeah, that's right.
Best thing about that movie.
All right.
Jason Reitman's got a directorial debut called Bad Words, where he plays a 40-year-old guy who enters the National Children's Spelling Bee.
No, you meant Jason Bateman.
Yes.
You said Reitman.
Right. I'm sorry. Jason Bateman. Yes.
Jason Bateman. Okay.
His directorial debut. A lot of people will compare it to Bad Santa, except this one's really funny.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Well, that's right. You and I are in the same boat on Bad Santa.
That we are.
Because I hate that movie. It's not funny.
No, this one involves a lot of swearing at children and bad behavior towards children, but it's really, really funny.
Cool. And Catherine Hahn is in it.
Yes.
And Allison Janney. Wow, what a cast.
Great cast.
Rachel Harris, Philip Baker Hall. Man.
Mm-hmm.
Good
yep.
for all right.
He's got a grudge against the spelling bee, and so he enters to sort of take it down.
That's awesome. That sounds great. So that's Jason Bateman's directorial debut. He's also in it, and it's called Bad Words. Okay, next.
August Osage County. Tracy Butts' play into a movie with John Wells. Talk about great cast. You can't really beat this one. And this is a good movie. I don't think it's quite the groundbreaking thing, the thing that changes people's lives the way everyone's associated with this thing seem to suggest it is. But if you just want to see, you know, just A-class acting across the board, starting with Meryl Streep and Julia Roberts and Chris Cooper, you can't go wrong with this. I mean, that's what you're going to see this movie for, is great acting, and that's what you get. I don't think it's anything more than that, but that's fine.
I saw it on stage, and I liked it. You know, but I don't think it deserved a Pulitzer, but I enjoyed it. I'll tell you what, I'm looking forward to it, but I don't think it's going to be better than Killer Joe, but that's just me.
It's not better than Killer Joe. And when you see the film, remember that I said it goes on 90 seconds too long.
Okay, I will.
Remember
I will.
That.
All right, I will. That's August. Osage County comes out in October based on Tracy Letts' Pulitzer Prize winning play. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Next.
Documentary called Jodorowsky's Dune. This is the documentary story of how Alejandro Jodorowsky, who did El Topo and Holy Mountain, was going to make Dune back in the 70s, well before Star Wars came out, and it's insane. He's like, what do you want to do next? And he goes, Dune, and he had never read it.
The guy's a lunatic.
He's a lunatic, but in a great way.
Oh, yeah.
In a great way. And this documentary is fun, and it goes through the process of all the storyboards and all the crazy stuff,
man.
How he wanted to have different composers for every planet. You know, that's the kind of nuts this thing
Good.
Is.
Cool.
And it's a lot of fun. It really is.
Good. I can't wait to see that. That's great. I love his movies. All right. Well, Eric, thanks, man. I appreciate the coverage, and people can go online and read your stuff, right?
Yeah, I'm starting to work on some of the reviews and whatnot.
Right.
It's 43 movies, man.
That's a lot. Well, listen, welcome back.
And
thanks, man. We'll talk to you next week.
Absolutely.
All right, there you go. Eric Childress will be back next week. And Dave Flyer is up next right here on WGN.